Hi everyone, and welcome to a new edition of Talk Hockey Radio. It's been a while, and we're back. And obviously, I've got my co-hosts with me, Simon and Fraser. Hello there, boys.
Hello.
How's half?
That was very exciting, Simon.
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic. I'm optimistic with this one we broadcast.
Oh, yeah. that's low.
Let's start off as we need to. Congratulations on escaping Batra's basement, Taff. I'm sure it was a long and arduous journey to get out.
Thanks a lot. We were talking off air about some of these stuff, and we're going to lead with our resident umpire here, and it's a hot topic. So we're going to lead with you, Si, on our first topic. And maybe you can introduce it and then kind of like explain it a little bit as well, because I'm kind of finding it hard to understand. Maybe it's not that hard to understand, but I'm not an umpire. So,
yeah. So basically a trial has been announced for a new penalty corner rule, whereby effectively it's no longer really a penalty corner. All the attackers have to stand outside the hatched area of the circle. The injectors where they normally are, and there's five defenders who now have to be in the goal, whereas before they could be outside between the two lines either side of the goal. And then all the other defenders have to be back at the baseline. You can have as many attackers as you want up, apart from the goalkeeper, obviously, like normal. Ball has to be injected, and then it has to go outside the 5 metre hatched area, at which point all normal rules of the game apply. When it first came out, there was talk of whether or not it was some elaborate wind-up, which I first heard from FIH umpires because they thought it was such an appallingly dumb idea. And that made sense to me because normally when the FIH announce stuff, you can find it on a website. It comes through some sort of fancy press release, but this didn't. So it maybe made sense, but no, it has been since confirmed that it's genuine. It's mostly been very badly received. Some people think it will work. Apparently something similar has happened in Australia. The concern that myself and other umpires have and players is the rationale behind this is it will create an overload situation where the attacking team will want to play it around like a normal traditional open play overload and then try and tap it in on the far post so it's safer. But the pressure is you've got the defenders retreating back from the halfway line, so you want to get your shot away before you lose your overload. On top of that, normal rules apply. So when you bring it back to the circle, you can tank it at head height if you want to, as long as it's a legitimate shot on goal. Normal safety rules apply. So obviously, if someone's less than 5 metres away, you can't do that. But realistically, people will do it anyway. At a low level of the game, it's going to be absolute carnage because you're going to have no defenders can get there in time. At international level, defenders can barely get to the top of the circle just as the ball's coming in for the first shot. So unless you can find a defender who can cover 14.6 metres and get to the top of the circle faster than the ball can travel out and an attacker can carry it 5 metres in and twat it, this is not safer. It's less controlled. From an umpiring point of view, your position is going to be spaffed because you need to be far enough out you can see the control area where the action's taking place. You also need to be able to see if the players are outside of 5 metres. The support umpires obviously also going to want to try and help you see if they're outside the 5 metres or if they break in early before the ball injection happens. So your proximity and ability to judge things is potentially compromised there. And it's fine if you've got TV and video referral and so on, but that's not most hockey. But they're saying that it will remove the need for safety equipment and it will make it safer. I've almost never seen anyone get properly hurt on a penalty corner. Almost every serious injury has happened in open play. There's been no data published to validate this argument that we need this rule change. And it just seems reckless in every way possible in terms of the decision to do it. It looks like there was no actual data driving for it to happen. In terms of a tactical side of it, it might work at elite hockey where they've got the skill level and the competency to be able to quickly ping it around and tap it in on the far post. But as soon as you go to a lower level, but even the international players I've spoken to all think the same thing. People will just go in and twat it. So it can be less controlled and less predictable than the current system, which has a very focused area of control, which is basically slightly wide of a goal. You've got like probably 2-3 metres either side of a goal, straight line. That's where all the action happens in a penalty corner.
Yeah.
Whereas now, then they come in and just lash it. Yeah. And it's, to me, it's madness.
So let me get this straight, right? Okay. They can still do the Pelicana normal.
No.
No, they can't. Okay, so this is just basically replacing all that.
Yep. So no, not what you think of as a traditional penalty corner, ball had to come out, had to be controlled, and then it could come back in.
That's gone.
Okay. Now, the penalty corner effectively is a setup overload where you have someone injecting from the baseline to potentially nine other attacking players on the edge of a circle, or edge of a hatched area, charging against five defenders, including the goalkeeper.
Okay.
So,
oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I actually thought, you know, when I was reading it about, yeah, it does sound crazy anyway. I mean, obviously, Fraser, you can jump in this as well, right? I thought, oh, right, okay, so you can choose to do it this way or you can choose to do it the normal, you know. But if it's just replacing it, that's crazy. Because in terms of, from what my understanding is, previously, you could do it the normal way where it comes outside the solid D and then you bring it inside to have it obviously have a shot and stuff like that. And obviously that would work. And but if it went beyond the hash D, it was actually open play and it would create an overload situation. But that would only be in the sense of if you mistrack the ball or if that was one of your routines.
Yeah.
But this is completely getting rid of the first bit.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, so there's no short corner rule effectively. Once a ball's gone out of the hatched area, it's normal play. So from what I understand, if the injector spaffs it up and it doesn't go out of the circle like normal, then the attackers would have to frantically get in there and then shell it back outside the hatched area. Otherwise, the corner hasn't effectively ended and you're not in open play yet.
Okay. Wow. Okay. That's ridiculous. Well, Fraser, you're a coach as well, so you...
Yeah. So, a few things about the document that came out. Number one, it was only the first page of, I believe, a 3 or 4 page...
It's three, yeah, I've seen the full-size one, it's 3 pages.
So there's a lot more definitions of rules and how it will affect the penalty corner. But what's also not in there is there's no... this will be trialled at this tournament, this will be... in place at this level, this is how it's going to work.
Yeah,
it's literally here is a suggested trial, so we have no kind of context for it as to whether this is something that's definitely going forward, whether this is like an internal pitch of this trial. There's a lot to be discussed around that, but I think looking at what has come out, it's a stupid idea. What I was going to say is, if you remember back when they brought in the field goals were worth 2 and penalty corners were worth 1 for a trial, quite a few teams did this where they played the ball outside the 5-yard dash and then brought it back in and immediately had a shot. And I think the average length of time for a penalty corner at international level is around 3 seconds from injection to kind of ball crossing the baseline, either as a goal or missing kind of thing. And when they took it outside of the 5-yard dash, the average time was a little over 4.2 or something like that. So it's not adding a great deal of time and it's giving people free rein to have a shot at any height, which is surely much more dangerous than a controlled shot from the top D.
Has there been any official sort of like releases from, you know, national governing bodies to say they are going to implement this at a certain level, or is it just going to be trialed at international level?
The FIH have made it available that anyone who wants to trial it is welcome to trial it. Okay. So in terms of insurance, it would go under FIH rules. So you'd be insured if you did say, yeah, we'll trial this, because you're not like, you know how like the Americans have 1,000,001 different versions of rules of hockey. This would be the 1,000,002nd version. So they can opt in effectively. Otherwise, you can keep it as it is.
Yeah.
My club, we've already had people say to me, they will not defend penalty corners if this rule comes in.
Yeah. And
won't play if this rule comes in because they can see it as being so recklessly dangerous.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like when they brought in the own goal rule, people just started twatting it in, hoping it might hit something and go in.
Yeah.
And after a year, they thought, yeah, this was a really dumb idea. They got rid of it. This one's more obviously stupid, so probably shouldn't be implemented in the first place. Yeah. But there are, to be fair, there's some respectable people who I disagree with them on this, but I normally respect their opinion. I do respect their opinion. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to defend it and say, give it a go. And someone pointed out the sky didn't fall in when we brought in self-pass, and the sky didn't fall in when offside was brought out of hockey and other rule changes that have happened.
Yeah.
But this one does look pretty bad.
Yeah.
So a few points. They talk about wanting to phase out protective equipment, but as of part of the trial, all protective equipment will stay the same. But it's basically open play, and they hate defenders having additional protective equipment during open play because they say it's a greater risk to other players in the circle if there's any collisions. So surely lengthening the amount of time where it's going to be kind of an open play situation where defenders are going to have protective equipment on,
yeah,
is going to make it initially much more dangerous. So bringing in a rule to make it safer while also making it more dangerous seems a bit counterproductive.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's crazy. I'm not sure what the stance is for England hockey here in this country in terms of whether they're saying, yeah, if you want to do it, then you can do it. National governing bodies or whatever. Regional governing bodies. Maybe
They're not allowed to in England anymore.
Okay, right. So it'd have to come from England hockey anyway, right? Yeah. And would that be would that be, I'm playing a bit devil's advocate in here, would that be, you know, let's say for instance, Northwest hockey, sort of like saying, right, okay, England hockey said we can do it, but we're not going to do it.
I believe that because the under the new structure that England hockey's got for areas and whatever the thing below an areas that used to be a county, you have to follow all the same rules. So the rules and the structures are meant to be the same in every area, so it translates and it's easier for people to understand what's going on. So I can't imagine that you could decline it at a local level.
No, it's I get that.
Possible, but it is very difficult. I think the Yorkshire League had some pushback around swapping from halves to quarters, and so it was allowed to continue on just because of pitch availability and booking time. You're trying to fit everything in. They basically said they couldn't run the league.
We at Northwest basically do that as well. We just play halves, so we don't play quarters anyway.
Yeah, it's halves below National League.
So that's okay, I suppose, but maybe if they want to trial this and do it, maybe they should do it at National League level or whatever, because I just think, like you guys have said, it's going to be a little bit carnage. And also the fact that, you know, not every club or every pitch out there has a hash or dash D. Yeah. So,
and even the ones that do, some of them are faded because they've been added later with cheap spray paint.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, my club has got a permanent, you know, stitched in dash D's, but I'm sure, like you're saying, you know, your club or maybe other clubs will probably not have that. And if they don't have that, they're going to have to get someone to actually do it and paint it out or something, whatever. That's an extra cost, I suppose. Unless, like, you know, if it's a school, they might just do it anyway. But if it's like your own pitch, that's an extra cost for you, isn't it, really? Having to repaint it, do it over time when it gets faded. Yeah, I
think we're overlooking the most important bit as well. That drag legs are cool.
Yeah, that as well. I mean, you know, that's getting rid of all these drag flicks as well. But, you know, another thing I was thinking about is that even though the ball comes out outside the dash D or whatever, can the players still stand on the solid
No, they have to stand up. Players have to start outside.
All right.
As soon as the ball moves, they can go. But the ball has to, as soon as the ball moves, they're allowed to go.
Yeah, just like it would be normally.
Yeah, but then that creates the other problem that, like, let's say it comes out dead center, top of the circle, outside the hatched area, everyone goes running in on the angle.
Yeah.
At the same time, you've got the defenders running towards the ball. You've now got a bigger run of them coming, and they're going to have to be looking for the ball at a lower level. They definitely would be higher level. They're prepared to dive blind, go for deflections, but lower down, people never dive blind.
No.
So they're going to collide with people. So we're manufacturing a situation where we're running faster because they had a bigger buildup.
Yeah.
So I was discussing this with someone recently. Would you run and block the options and force the shot from top D? Because I think a lot of good goalkeepers would quite happily face the shot from top D. So the runners would scatter and just block the option.
Yeah, it's easier as a goalkeeper to save a straight strike than to face the deflection.
In which case, we're just reverting back to someone shooting from top D.
Yeah. East has always gone a little bit backwards then, doesn't it, really, in that case?
Yeah.
It's moving in a big pointless circle, which I find very entertaining, but also really pointless.
So have any of you come across any of the, let's say, national governing bodies that saying that they're going to say
this? No one's made a comment about it.
Oh, okay, so we've got nothing.
You're all too busy focusing on more important things like qualifying for the Olympics than dealing with some Frankenstein idea.
Yeah, I only asked because I've not seen anything on social media or anything like that, or even an official... release to say, we're going to take this on board because it feels so great.
As of yet, I don't think the FIH has officially put it up on the website, have they?
Someone
made a statement, but I don't think they've actually published it themselves.
Well, that was why it looked like it was probably a fake thing, because why would you not have it on the website? Why would you not have done a proper press release? And if it's been leaked, then you react to it rather than just twiddling your thumbs, which is what they're doing.
I honestly thought it was a wind-up, like possibly, more than half of the people that were actually looking at it, I thought it was a wind-up, thinking, we've had things before, haven't we, where someone's released something like that, and then sort of like said, oh no, it was just a bit of a wind-up, we just wanted to see.
It'd be a pretty crap wind-up, but yeah, anyway, I don't know as much more to say about it.
Some people say April Fool's already, you know what I mean?
To close up on this, so... they are wanting to kind of depower the drag flick. But I think that's only interesting in close games.
Mm.
Like, you look at some of the Pro League results that we've seen this season. Spain were able to drag their way back into a game against the Netherlands, who went on to win in the men's, using counterattacks, getting in the D, winning a penalty corner and scoring goals. If we depower the penalty corner and just make it a attacking overload, which you can argue it's already an attacking overload now, we're just taking away that direct shot potentially, it's going to make those games much less interesting to watch, because the underdog team doesn't have that go-to strategy of, right, if we get in the D and we don't get a chance, we'll manufacture a penalty corner because we know it's a good scoring chance. So it makes the game more boring to watch and more predictable, which is something we want to get away from.
I mean, I think this is going to be, it's going to be one of those situations where it is boring, because it's just it's just open play. There's no, we've got no, it doesn't seem as though it's unique in any sort of way.
Well, the other thing is, do you remember when Harry Martin got nutted by someone wearing one of those oboe face masks?
Yeah.
That's going to happen more, because they're going to be running faster and blinder, because the attackers will be looking at what's going on around them. But anyway, I really can't think of any instances where I've seen major injuries occur in penalty corner routines. They are all in open play.
So one other complaint I've seen with penalty corners is the amount of time taken to set up and go and put on the protective equipment, which at the minute is 40 seconds, which is nothing.
It's enough.
We've talked about it before. You said it should be longer.
Yeah, it's enough if they don't talk and argue. But
do you know how long it takes to take a free kick in football?
An eternity. But football's
so, as an example, just because it came out around the same time as this document leaked, Messi's debut goal for Inter Miami, late free kick in the game, from the foul being given to Messi kicking the ball is around 2 minutes. That's 2 minutes of the ball being positioned, the ref drawing his little circle round with his foam spray, pacing his 10 yards, drawing the line, the goalkeeper setting up the wall, Messi placing the ball, picking the ball up, dusting off the blade of grass that it's got on it, putting it back down, turning it, pacing out his steps, looking at the referee to ask if he's allowed to take it yet, being told no, going back, picking up the ball, turning it around so the Valve is facing a different direction, so it spins differently, whatever he's doing. Out again, told he can take it, takes the free kick. 2 minutes. The fact that there's a 40-second break for people to put on protective equipment is really nothing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Okay, anyway. Well, people listening to this, let us know what your thoughts are. I'm sure we might discuss it again at some point, and when they scrap it, of course. But yeah, anyway, let's move on. I think we've talked it out a little bit too much, haven't we? Okay, so next one, guys. Talking about the Pro League, Fraser, before, New Zealand pulling out the Pro League. Thoughts on that, boys?
Can't say I'm massively surprised. It's probably a good idea.
I think we've discussed this before, haven't we? Or you know, like teams pulling out or whatever.
One of our many lost episodes.
Yeah, sorry. Look, Mr. Batra had me, okay? So I can't, you know... you can't blame me for that, I'm sorry.
Yeah, like, I mean, as Sam says, it's kind of understandable. I think with the men's getting relegated, it just became financially unfeasible for them to send one team around the world and send the other team off to relative qualifying tournaments and whatever.
But that, isn't that what they cited? It was the citing of
financial viable barrier. Also, it's a better focus of their time and energy to qualify for the Olympics by going through their continental qualification process. Yeah. Because realistically, they're not going to go from being the second or third worst team in Pro League to being number one, which is the only way they could do it for Pro League.
Yeah.
It's not a surprise. I think there's going to be more countries to follow suit fairly soon because it's not economically viable. And even with the adjusted system they've got in place coming where it's more like a traditional sort of tournament basis, still not massively viable. But the real stupidity is just popping the Americans back in rather than letting Spanish go in who finished second in the competition below.
Yeah.
So we're just, what if the American get dicked on again? It's just ridiculous. And it's not going to benefit them. They should be playing in the lower competition where they'd actually develop and not spend their time just getting obliterated by people. And instead, having they had, two games, I think, in the whole tournament where it wasn't embarrassing. They narrowly lost to the Dutch and they narrowly lost to GB. Otherwise, they lost every game badly. What's the benefit for anyone involved? Let the Spanish in, who also have the men's team in, so it's more economically viable.
Mm-hmm.
And... But, you know, the Spanish women are not a bad team. They're routinely contending for medals at European Championships.
Yeah.
And the one of the Welsh guys, I think it was, maybe it was Scottish, pointed out that Poland's hosting the next Nations Cup for men or something like that, or one of the qualifying things. And they're, like, ranked 29th in the world, and there's loads of teams above them who haven't got a sniff at it. How does that work?
Bring back Champions Trophy, I say.
Bring back Batra. We need that.
No, thanks. No, thanks.
We should also mention as well, obviously it happened between last broadcast episode, TAF's incarceration and TAF's release, is South Africa qualifying for the Pro League and then opting not to go because they couldn't raise the funds. There's a lot of talk of how they dropped out and that they didn't let the players know that they weren't going to do it. A lot of players have self-funded themselves into the nation's qualifying tournament to then get told that they weren't going to go to the Pro League because the South African Hockey Association couldn't afford to send them without telling them, and it just came out in the newspapers. It's not great, but I believe in the report they talked about it costing somewhere around £500,000, or it might have said dollars, I'm not 100% sure anymore, to be part of it, which... Obviously, South Africa would have a lot of travel to do, but I can't say it would be substantially less than New Zealand would have of flying around the world.
Yeah.
So I can understand why, if one of the two teams was knocked out, they would have to pull the other one.
Yeah. Like I said, bring back the Champions Trophy. It was such a great tournament. You know, we were obviously involved in it when it was here and hosted here a few times. It was brilliant. Everyone enjoyed it. It was a week-long tournament. You had, like, what was it, 10, 12 teams, wasn't it? I can't remember now. Whoever won that went over to do Champions Trophy 1 or 2 and things like that. And it was a much better, much more fairer competition, to be honest with you. Because if you're in, if you're in the Champions Two, you could actually, if you were the top in that one, you could actually go to the Champions One thing. But this Pro League and all the other regional tournaments at the moment don't actually. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's fair enough. But yeah, we should bring back the Champions Trophy. Make a campaign. I don't know. Viva la Revolution.
I think I've worked out why Taff got locked up by Batra.
well, because I was so adamant about doing this.
Yeah. I'm violently overthrowing the FIH.
Oh God. Okay. Right. Swiftly moving on.
So we've talked about the FIH pulling away from broadcast television and putting everything condensed into the Watch.hockey app.
Yeah. Thoughts on that, Si?
I'm not surprised. I don't think that there's been much value creation from Pro League in terms of like television audiences. Over here, obviously, we've had it on BT Sport for a while.
Yeah.
And I'm at matches if I can watch it. So I can't really comment much on the quality of a broadcast. I think they gave it their best shot. But, you know, it also doesn't look great having so many empty stands. And that's an FIH mistake to allow midweek fixtures at 12:30. That's just unforgivably dumb. And also an element of it being stuck in London. I think if it, you know, when it went up to Durham, the crowds were massive. When we've had it in other parts of the country before, the crowds have been good. Let it tour around, and you might get a crowd like they do in other countries where they move it around, particularly in Germany and in the Netherlands and Belgium, they move it around. They get good crowds. I think it's so counterintuitive to use Watch.hockey. It's an obstruction for finding a small sport. You know, it might be a really well participated sport, primarily because of India and Pakistan, but it is a well participated sport. But if you're going to get organic traction, you need people to be able to find you organically. And having an awkward, weird website name or an app, which in our experience barely ever works, or it's just rolling adverts for Odisha, it's just, I don't know. I don't think it's a good idea, personally. I can understand taking it away from broadcasters because no one's buying it, fair enough, apart from in India. But to me, YouTube is always the answer. I know it's boring, but it does the trick. And you can charge people if you really want to. Charge them 99p a game. Make a lot more money than the $14.99 pass to watch the Spanish Invitational Tournament.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, like you're saying, it can be behind a paywall as well, doesn't it? Can't it? On YouTube as well. And plus, a lot of people know what YouTube is. Only just, though. Only just. Fraser, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sam's covered it pretty well. Watch.hockey initially, especially, was just riddled with bugs and didn't work. It's improved, but it's still not great. And they're now individually paywalling every tournament. So if you want to watch the Spanish Invitational that's just taken place, it was £14. The Asia Games that's coming up, I think, is £10. Yeah, so the Asia Games, they're paywalling again. The Euros are going to paywall again. And it's just putting up barriers again of people trying to watch. People didn't like the broadcast television because they had to pay various amounts of money to get access. There was no kind of drop-in, I just want to watch the hockey. It's going to be £5 or whatever it is for a month to watch it. It's, you have to buy the entire sports pack, which is great if you already are buying the sports pack, but if you have to go out of your way to get it, obviously not as good.
So,
but it takes away casual fans. So yeah. I know several people personally who pay for all sports channels because that's all they really watch. And they have watched hockey just because they were flicking through the channel, saw it was on, and decided to watch it.
Yeah.
We've now lost that entire audience.
Okay, well, we all know what we think about the .hockey app, guys. So I don't think we should spend too much time on this. Let's move on. What's the next one?
Spanish tournament, which you could only watch on that.
Oh, right, okay. So we're still on the Watch.hockey hockey app. Brilliant. So, yeah. I mean, do they have a monthly subscription? Or is it paid per tournament?
I think
maybe they should have a subscription, £10 or £15 or whatever for the whole month. A lot of people will take maybe have that as an uptake rather than individual tournaments costing them X amount of money, because it could end up being costing them £30-40 if there's like two or three tournaments throughout that month. Thoughts?
You go, Fraser.
I think the tournament pass model is stupid. I think, like you say, even if it's a monthly amount and you watch whatever hockey you want during that period, that could be international hockey, that could be club level hockey, they could actually work with national governing bodies and broadcast out national league games so that people can go and watch. And if you really want to, you can go and watch the Dutch league, go watch the Belgian league, you can go and watch Germans, Australian. Because at the minute, you can't. It's a massive pain to go and watch international club level hockey. The only real exception is the Dutch league, because they do have some stuff that they get put onto YouTube. But as we know, the FIH has never heard of YouTube. They don't believe it exists. And so won't go that way. But at the minute, if you wanted to watch the Spanish Invitational Tournament, it was £14 and it was 5 days of hockey.
Yeah,
during working hours.
During working hours, obviously. Although we can get into that as well. The game times for this tournament were mad. It was like one game at 10 a.m. and then the next game was 5 p.m. Nothing in between. I assume to avoid the midday heat.
Yeah, it will have been.
But why put one game on at 10 and one game on at 5 and that be it for the day? Why not put one game on at 5, one game on at 7? I suppose after 7 o'clock is the Spanish bedtime. But to be fair, it was free entry if you were there. Anyone could go in and watch. It looked like they had decent crowds a lot of the time. So
yeah, I think it's the tournament was an interesting one. England women finished last and England men finished second, which is our specialist now that we can finish second or third, yeah, or fourth, just miss out. But I know that they're working hard. I'm sure that they will get over the line. I'm only joking about that habit. The women's worrying me. I think that's worrying. And whilst it's not super duper serious, and we lost Hannah Martin midway through the tournament, which is a massive hit, and we don't have Anna Toman, which is also a massive hit, I don't think anyone was necessarily surprised that they did as well as they did or did as badly as they did.
Yeah.
It's good to see Katie Curtis get her debut.
Oh, yeah.
She's from my club, so I'm a bit biased. But she's a quality hockey player. She once did something so insanely skillful that I gave her a free hit just for doing it. And then I realized afterwards that she hadn't actually been fouled. It was just so insane what she did. But yeah, so I think she's a great addition to the team. She, obviously, I know her fairly well from Cambridge, but when she's been playing for the under-21s, she's handled the pressure really well. She had to do a shootout twice where there was a balls up with a clock or a whistle. I can't remember what it was. So she had to go twice, and she handled the pressure well. She's captained her university team to promotion, I think, and to retaining Premier League status in the Vitality Premier League, as well as winning Bucks. So yeah, she's a good addition, but it's a bit worrying, the rest of it. And Darcy Bourne's out injured, Anna Toman's out injured, Hannah Martin might be out injured, Grace Bolson's just coming back. I think staying up in the Euros might be a challenge.
They've got a lot of new players though, right?
They do, and they've got Holly Hunt back, which is a really big asset to have back. So there is that.
Yeah. But
there's still the Maddie Hinch-shaped elephant in the room. So yeah, it's a bit worrying.
Well, you know, I thought you were going to say it's a small elephant.
it could be their development stage now at the moment. I don't know. I mean, if they have got a lot of new players in there, and could it be that they're building now? It's not probably not the right time to do it, really. But
we've got to get to the Olympics.
Yeah, I know.
It might be a bit late for the building, but I guess it's harder at home Commonwealth Games as well, because you don't want to have that. I don't know. Get Sophie Bray back.
Yeah, so, I mean, she was a good player. Definitely.
Well, there's rumours as to why she left, and maybe she'd come back now. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. Because things have changed a lot. Yeah. So
they got Joe Pinner is trying to get back in the squad.
Oh, really right.
One. Yeah, it's worth following her Instagram to see her journey coming back from being a mum. Well, not being back, she's still a mum. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah.
She's abandoned her child in search of returning to the GB hockey set. No. So a couple of points on the women's side of things. So it was a 3-team tournament, whereas the men's side was a 4-team tournament because I believe it was South African women's team didn't turn up.
Yeah.
And gave them very short notice, and so they couldn't arrange another team. So it was England, Spain, India. Having watched a few of the games, England did look like they were being outclassed at times and were just not in the games at all. So quite a worrying performance going into the European Championships. Obviously, there are a few big names who are missing. There's a few who are just coming back and need some time to kind of get back into kind of match shape, maybe. But yeah, they definitely looked to deteriorate through the short tournament.
Could be the fact that we've got a lot of inexperienced players, even though they might be, you know, very classy and great and skillful and stuff. But inexperience in terms of, like, you know, the international, you know, stage kind of thing. So hopefully they'll get settled in and maybe, I mean, like you're saying with your player, Sai, who's coming to the fold, inexperienced but very skillful. So once they've got some, you know, international tournaments under their belt, maybe they might start gelling a little bit more and not be outclassed, possibly. It's always difficult, isn't it? I mean, when you do have new players, it's always difficult to sort of like play against experienced and a team that have been together for quite a while and doing well against them as well.
Yeah, I don't know. The Indian team are obviously, I think they've not had much changeover and they're really going to be pushing for a medal in Paris.
Yeah.
Spain, when I looked at some of the squad, I didn't recognise a lot of that squad. They've had a lot of people step down, and actually in one picture it looked like the under-18s team had been put forward. So I don't know much about what's going on there. I did spot that Berta Banastra was training with them, which seemed an interesting one, but she didn't get in the squad, or maybe she's just there as assistant coach. I haven't asked her. Yeah. Should have done that before this recording. But yeah, it'd be interesting. The Spanish are always one of those ones where you think they could do something. Like, they've got some really good players,
yeah,
but they just don't quite get there. I really rate their coach. I think he's quality. And when you consider how tiny the pool of talent is in Spain, it's quite incredible they do so well. They've only got a few thousand players.
Yeah.
But
they've been playing a lot of friendly internationals, right, I think, from what I understand.
Yeah,
they have. So, you know, again, they're probably building on their, you know, new players and whatever and trying to get international games under their belt so that they can play well. And you know what? I actually like the Spanish team because I think sometimes they feel like they're the underdogs, but they can bring it out. You know, they can actually bring out a performance and think, and you think, wow, we weren't expecting that. So, you know, hopefully we'll end up being surprised again by them.
Yeah. We can turn to more positive things and talk about men.
Yeah, yeah, let's go for it. Yeah, yeah, go on.
Okay, first thing, the Netherlands came fourth, India came third, England came second, and the Spanish men's won. The final went to shootout, I believe, between England and Spain. And as we know, Spain are very good at shootouts.
Yeah. Did you catch a lot of the games?
I watched a few of them. I unfortunately was not able to watch all of them because I had this thing called a job. for some reason, they're
just
not.
In case your boss is listening to this.
No, he doesn't listen to me at work. He never listened to me outside of work. No, so just because of the times of some of the games, I couldn't watch them. So the ones I did watch, I thought at the start of the tournament, the Dutch looked very strong against England. I think that game ended 1-1. And then England continued against the Spanish and looked very dominant performance, finishing 3-1. And then I believe they drew with India, but again, they looked to be very dominant in that game.
That was 1-0, wasn't Spanish, it? 1-0?
No. The India game.
Yeah.
It might have been 1-0. I think England led for a lot of that game. I think they scored very early. The Spanish, I thought, started off looking not strong, but also kind of not out of their depth. But they seem to have got better in every game going forward. Their final game in the like mini tournament to qualify for the final against the Netherlands, I think they were 3-1 down and just would not stop coming. And the Netherlands had no answer for it towards the end of the game. I think if the game had gone on another 5 minutes, Spain could have gone on and won. So
they seem to do a lot of that, though, don't they? They kind of like look like they're struggling throughout the game or whatever, and they'll bring it out of the bag in the last 5 or 10 minutes sometimes. And they've always done that, haven't they? It's like they've got like extra energy for that last 5 or 10 minutes. They're like, I don't know, they might be like at 50%, and suddenly they're at 75% because they're really, really going for it for that last 10 minutes or whatever.
I think they thrive on the idea that they're the underdogs and that they're sometimes being victimized as well. Like, that's you can see, like, being there at matches as a photographer, you can obviously hear a lot of the conversations. And whilst I don't understand Spanish, my grasp of English is fairly good. And they do maybe complain more about decisions that other teams do and feel like things are going against them or whatever. Or but I think they've got a good spine down the team. And actually, when they lost their goalkeeper, who'd been their goalkeeper for an eternity and was one of the best keepers in the world, I thought, oh, that's a hard hit. Actually, the guy who stepped in is phenomenal. And his deputy is also very good. And the youngster, yeah, they've got some really good players in that squad. And watching them at Pro League, you could really see that they can graft, they can get something out of a tough game. And that's not something they've always been able to do. So it's quite an interesting time to watch them. Did find it funny the Dutch finishing fourth, but I'm also sure they probably didn't care very much about this tournament. They're not exactly going to reveal anything particularly exciting, are they?
No, definitely not. Okay.
England, though, yeah, I don't want to jinx them, but here we go. They should be trying to win the Euros. I think it's going to be tough, but I think they could do it. They're a good enough team, and they're learning. And this could be a real major milestone for them if they could pull that off. I think once they've broken it, if they've won that first tournament as a squad, it's going to be massive. Yeah. Maybe it'd be good to get some people in the coaching staff who have won stuff, like get some of the guys from 2009 to help out, or some of the guys who've gone and played in the top, like in the Dutch division or whatever, on the mentality side. But the group dynamic is the best I've ever seen it. They can score open play, they can score penalty corners, maybe not as many as they should be scoring, but they can still do it sometimes. And then both the goalkeepers are phenomenal. And the Welsh guy who made his debut under the GB colours as well looks very good. So when we go back to GB, I think he'll be a great addition to have back in the squad as well. When you've got three very, very good goalkeepers, that's a fantastic position to be in.
Yeah.
Just all across the park, it's looking good.
Yeah, cool.
Especially Brendan Cleary's hair.
Okay, let's move on then. I think unless you've got anything else to say, Fraser. No, I think it'll be exciting to watch some of the men's sides for sure. Okay, so next thing, anything else on the horizon? Anyone? Any other topic?
Simon wanted to talk about the Masters.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was a very nice thing to talk about.
Yeah, go on then.
God, let's start with the
Sorry, what are you saying, Fraser?
I said let's start with the umpire shirts.
Oh yeah.
I liked them. So the umpire shirts were rainbow shirts, and some people assumed that this was some sort of LGBT statement. It wasn't. It was just
so they didn't clash with any of the various countries turning up.
Yeah, so there's lots of reasons. So it's the Japanese National League shirt, and it is basically exactly the same. I think having looked someone put a photograph of a Japanese one to explain the story, and even down to the collar, it looks like the same dimensions that we've got. So that's their shirt. They've used the rainbow shirt for ages. Then when they had the Masters World Cup, I can't remember what age groups it was, but they had it in Japan last year, and they were very popular. In Nottingham, they went the traditional way of having a million different shirt colours for each umpire. So you had like blue, yellow, pink, orange, whatever. And that's a lot of shirts to potentially have to buy, either as the umpire or as the tournament. Whereas with these, they're not going to clash with anyone. So that was why we went with it. Also, I think there's an element of brand identity and trying to have something that's a bit iconic, which it works with. So yeah, the shirts were good. I liked them. Not everyone was a fan. There was an umpire, Furphy and Lucy both went for it, big guns. Lucy did a hair, not in rainbow style, but not too far off it. And then this woman called Furphy, who came all the way from Australia to umpire at the tournament, just the most incredible amount of accessories, rainbow based. So I was very impressed by her. Yeah, the tournament was good. Nottingham, we had over 35s to over 50s, men and women. Teams included the likes of Italy, Spain, France, Germany, Netherlands, England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland. I'm sure I'm forgetting someone. I said France. I think that's it then. But yeah, it was really good, very competitive. Umpiring wise, it's quite an experience because you do it like we had a full FIH style briefing. We had to give lots of information about what cards were given for and how goals are scored. All this technical stuff, it's all on Altruist or however you pronounce that thing. Quality of the tournament was really high. We had a special guest spectator from Sheffield come along as well. Who's on this call?
Small amount of heckling.
Did you heckle whilst I was umpiring? I can't remember.
No.
I think you got by that.
I was told I wasn't allowed to stay around just to heckle Simon umpiring.
No, it was really good. I mean, from a personal point of view, it's one of the most enjoyable hockey things I've ever done. The umpiring group, we're a mixture of a few different nationalities, so it was interesting hearing different approaches. We had a really good umpire support network from the umpire managers who, after every game, we had a debrief, which really accelerated everyone's development a lot. And it was great also to see top quality umpires up close game after game after game and be able to debate things and discuss things with them and so on. And then also with the players after the games, have a chat over a beer about different things, which was really good. I think England won most of them. There were a few shocks, or not shocks if you watch the whole tournament necessarily, but people were still surprised by some of the results. I think England versus Ireland for women's over 35s, that was a really good game. I missed it because I was umpiring a match at the same time, but I caught the shootout. Ireland won it, which maybe did surprise some people, but I think a draw was probably a fair result on what I saw in the tournament. And then a shootout's a shootout, anything can happen. Germany were great, really good fun, really nice bunch of lads. Scotland, fantastic as well. The Dutch and the German women were also like such a high standard. I stuck a picture up on Instagram and someone commented, I realized that this woman I had umpired earlier in the day was like some massive ex-Olympian. And that's the quality of the tournament. You have some amazing players at it. Also witnessed the most blatant form of cheating I've ever seen on a hockey pitch. So that was quite something to behold. I was doing a bronze medal match. And a German player block tackled, ball got drilled into her hand, and she wasn't wearing a glove. So she obviously dropped her stick and she was shaking her hand in pain and whatever. And she walked off the pitch to go and get ice. And then play started coming back towards where she dropped her stick. So she walked on the pitch and laid down to stop play.
Oh, really? Because
one of the tournament directions we had was you do not stop time unless you absolutely have to. Yeah. So she knew we wouldn't stop the game unless it was for safety. So she just laid down to stop play. That's
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, well, but it was a really good tournament. Some amazing goals. Gareth Andrews scored one of the best goals I've ever seen in my life. Just like one-handed, slicing it on a 45 degree angle as it came from behind him. He sliced it into over the goalkeeper or whatever. It was insane. he tried it again in the final, didn't pull it off, but he scored a nice goal, so it's fair enough. I mean, Beeston or Nottingham Hockey Centre did a very good job in general of hosting it.
Yeah.
And then the stuff in Valencia looks like it's gone well as well. And I think it's also worth giving a little shout out to Lynn Morgan, who made her Wales debut. And she's very pleased with that. I think she's probably more excited about that than getting an MBE or whatever it was. She got a BE.
She was. Yeah, she was. Definitely. What an accomplishment though, as well, anyway. Both of them.
Yes. Really. Yeah, she's done all right, that lady.
Yeah. She's just like she's a hockey badger, isn't she? She's
that's like, a little bit.
she's like at every tournament, every tournament really. You know, in the UK and a lot of the international ones she goes to as well. So, God, great lady though. Love her. Always shouts my name if she sees me on the pitch and all that. but yeah, she's really good. Well, talking about the umpiring shirts, I actually like you. I actually like them. Like you're saying, a lot of people don't or didn't, and probably still don't. But I think the negativity was that the umpires were hard to be seen, and you know, and then somebody else, Satellite, said, maybe that's the idea, though, isn't it? Do umpires really need to be seen? They just need to be heard. Do you know what I mean? So if you blew the whistle, you know where the umpire is.
Yeah, they do need to be able to find you quickly to figure out, like, especially if they don't speak English, they need to be able to find you quickly. So I do agree that was a bit of a unfortunate thing. And obviously when it happened in Japan, there was no crowds there because of COVID stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas we had, for some of the games, we had very good crowds. Like, I did an over 35s semi-final and there was a massive crowd by hockey standards, obviously. Like the whole pitch was lined both sides, one or two people deep, so that's a pretty decent crowd for hockey. And yeah, I think finding us, even someone as big as me, it was still quite a challenge.
Not as challenging as finding cover on that day I was there when the rain started.
Yeah.
Oh, did you get drenched then, Fraser?
Yeah, I've never seen such a mass migration to the small shop as the only place undercover that people could get to.
Oh, on the final night, they had an evacuation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because there was a big thunderstorm. So everyone was on it. I think I was probably about 8 or 9 beers in by this point. And they just pulled everyone in. But because of the time of day, all the change rooms have been shut. Yeah. So most of us ended up in the stairwell. There's a few videos of someone like brought in like massive speakers and disco lights and turned the bottom of the stairwell at Nottingham Hockey Centre into a nightclub for about an hour. And then upstairs, you just could not move. It was absolutely swarmed with people. But no, it was really good. It was a really nice event and really good to chat with players, some of whom I've known from years and years and years, and others only met in the last year or so. Yeah, really, really good event. Very much one of my favourite things I've ever done.
Did you say whether you like the shirts then, Fraser?
I like the shirts.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to buy one.
Yeah, you know what? You know,
Simon had such a problem trying to buy a shirt.
Yeah, I wanted more stash. I planned on buying 3 shirts, but I thought, I don't know, maybe I'll just get 2. So I went with 2. And then I convinced a German to swap his social shirt with me. And then I thought, no, I reckon I can get another one. But they'd sold out of my actual size, so I had to go down a size. And then Julie from Beeston basically exploited the fact that she's quite charismatic, charming, and good looking, and just running around swapping shirts for people. And I got, in fact, I'm wearing it now, a German playing shirt, which somehow she swapped a large for an extra large. But yeah. They did refuse to sell me it initially when I got the third shirt, because he was like, you have to be an umpire. And I was like, here's my umpire bag. I'm wearing umpiring stuff. I have a whistle. I can pay my green card instead of credit card. and he did eventually sell me it.
I wonder whether you can buy them, because I'd love one of those. Brilliant.
Yeah, they, were, Yeah, they were made for the tournament and it was meant to be umpires only. I think a few people got annoyed that players were able to go and buy them because earlier in the tournament I saw players buy them.
Oh, right, okay.
So I think Mason might have instigated a rule saying, no, you actually have to be an umpire to buy it. Yeah, to me, it's something you have to earn. It's like an NPOA shirt or whatever. You have to earn those.
I get that. All right. Exclusive clubs, Simon. Exclusive clubs.
I know. We're terrible people, that's umpires.
Well, on that note, I don't think we've got anything else to talk about, have we, guys? So we'll just basically say thank you for joining us. Thanks for being here again, Si and Fraser. And we will be back for sure next month. It's pre-season for our guys in England, so this will be a good podcast to get out there. So thank you very much, guys, and